Hello, and welcome to the Promise Institute podcast. My name's Jess Peak, and I am the Assistant Director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA School of Law. In this episode of the podcast, our Promise Institute Faculty Director, Asla Bali, talks with Jennifer Trahan, Ambassador David Sheffer, and Mohammed Al-Abdallah about the UN Security Council veto and atrocity crimes. This is the final episode in our fall 2020 season, and we want to thank all of our guests and listeners for making the podcast a success. Now, over to Asla.
My name is Asla Bali. I am a professor of law here at UCLA School of Law, and I'm the faculty director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights. And I am delighted to welcome you to this book launch event for Jennifer Trahan's Existing Legal Limits to UN Security Council Veto Power and Atrocity Crimes. It is a fantastic read, which I strongly recommend to everyone. And we're so delighted to have Jennifer here. I'm going to introduce our panelists first and foremost, the author of the book we are here to discuss, Jennifer Trahan, who is a clinical professor at NYU Center for Global Affairs, where she directs the concentration in international law and human rights and teaches a variety of courses on international law, leads the global field intensive to Bosnia, Serbia, and The Hague, and to Rwanda. She's a prolific scholar, having authored scores of law review articles and book chapters, including one on the International Criminal Court's crime of aggression. Her book, Existing Legal Limits to Security Council Veto Power in the Face of Atrocity Crimes, was published this summer by Cambridge University Press and is the winner of the 2020 ABILA, so American Bar Association's International Law Association, Book Award, Book of the Year Award. And she also served as amicus curiae to the International Criminal Court on the appeal of the situation regarding Afghanistan and serves on the Council of Advisors on the application of the ICC's Rome Statute to cyber warfare. So we are delighted to have Jennifer. I'm also going to take this occasion to introduce our two other panelists in the order in which they'll be speaking so that we can dispense with these wonderful bios and turn to the substance of our event. The first of our speakers will be Mohammed Al-Abdallah, who is the Executive Director of Syria Justice and Accountability Center, a nonprofit organization working on ensuring that human rights violations in Syria are comprehensively documented and preserved for use in transitional justice and peace building. Al-Abdallah is also a Syrian human rights and democracy researcher and activist. He receives his Bachelor's of Law from the Lebanese University and the Master's of Public Policy from George Mason University with a specialty in governance and international institutions. He's previously worked as a research assistant for Human Rights Watch in Beirut, where he covered Syria from 2007 to 2009. He's a former prisoner and survivor of torture who was imprisoned in Syria on two separate occasions for his work defending human rights and lobbying for political reform. And we're delighted to have you with us, and we look forward to a robust discussion of the Syria case in particular. And we are delighted, last but definitely not least, to have David Sheffer, clinical professor emeritus and director emeritus of the Center for International Human Rights at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. He was the first U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes issues from 1997 to 2001, and the U.N. Secretary General's special expert for U.N. assistance to the Khmer Rouge trials from 2012 to 2018. Ambassador Sheffer led the U.S. delegation to the U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court and signed the Rome Statute of the ICC on behalf of the United States on December 31st, 2000. He was senior advisor and counsel to the U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Dr. Madeleine Albright, and a member of the Deputies Committee of the National Security Council from 1993 to 97. He is currently the Tom Bernstein Genocide Prevention Fellow at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and visiting senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ambassador Sheffer is author of The Sit Room in the Theater of War and Peace from Oxford in 2019, and All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals, published by Princeton University Press in 2012. Welcome to all of you, and thank you so much for joining us for what I hope is going to be a very rich discussion of Jennifer's book. Jennifer, let's begin by asking you to set the book up for us. So what is the problem that the book is addressing, and what is your proposed solution for addressing that problem?
Great. Yeah, thanks so much, Asli. So the premise of my book is how the veto is being used by the permanent members of the UN Security Council is at odds with various aspects of our system of international law. And as a result, this fuels recurring cycles of violence and atrocity crimes around the world. So let me give you some examples of what I'm talking about. If we go back historically and look at apartheid South Africa, we have frequent veto use. It did not entirely paralyze the council. They did eventually impose mandatory sanctions, but it potentially did delay the dismantlement of apartheid. Regarding Rwanda, it was somewhat different. There were permanent members who didn't want the word genocide used because it might have implications they ought to be doing something. And there was really an underlying refusal or lack of interest in doing anything. So it was somewhat a different scenario. Regarding the situations of Darfur, Sri Lanka, and Myanmar, we have massive atrocity crimes in all three situations. And here it is more the veto threat that is at play. And note that the veto threat can act just as effectively as the veto because it absolutely brings the measure to a halt. And regarding Myanmar, there was one actual veto that years ago would have condemned the crimes. And the problem is if you can't even get out the condemnation, you know that the council is not going to be able to ratchet up to other measures. And also the fear is that the failure to even condemn the crimes may be sending a green light to perpetrators on the ground that they have a protector on the council. The US frequently uses its veto related to Israel, and my book does address all veto use in the face of atrocity crimes. I have particularly detailed chronologies relating to Darfur and Syria. Syria because it's a situation of actual veto use, Darfur veto threats. So in Darfur, what we see is accelerating crimes, the death tolls are climbing, crimes acknowledged to be war crimes, crimes against humanity, charged as genocide, certainly as all the hallmarks of genocide. At the same time, we see the veto threat watering down sanctions, watering down and delaying the peacekeeping deployment with a death toll of approximately 450,000. Regarding Syria, I'll just say briefly because Mohammed is gonna discuss this in more depth, but we basically have my book wrote about 14 vetoes. I think we're up to 16 by now. Vetoes that they can't get out condemnation of crimes. They can't refer the situation to the ICC. Six measures related to chemical weapons that they can't pass, including the joint investigative mechanism that would have attributed responsibility to the side using the weapons, and even humanitarian assistance. And on the joint investigative mechanism, let me just draw the linkage that when these chemical weapons inspections had started, we did have a decline in attacks. And when we have the refusal to renew the mandate of this mechanism, chemical weapons attacks seem to increase. So here we seem to have a direct correlation between veto use and fatalities on the ground. Put together this veto use and veto stress is clearly costing lives on the ground. So my book stresses we need to look at this in the context of our system of international law. And I do this at three levels. So the first is looking at the veto, which is found within the UN Charter, but we say at the level of jus cogens, so our highest level of international law, the prohibition of genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, you're all protected at this highest level. So my first argument actually is three formulations. Is at minimum inconsistent to say they're protected at this very highest level and yet freely veto regardless of what's going on? A more aggressive formulation, I actually think this was first suggested to me by David Sheffer when we were in the back of a cab in Sarajevo, if my memory is correct. He said, you know, this sounds like sometimes the veto is facilitating the crimes. And that indeed became my second argument, that sometimes our veto appears to be facilitating the perpetration or the continued perpetration of the crimes. And on my third argument of my first argument is it violates the ILC articles on responsibility of states for internationally wrongful acts, Article 41.1. That recognizes a duty of states to cooperate to bring to an end through lawful means any serious breach of an obligation arising under a peremptory norm of general international law. My second set of arguments look at the veto in the context of the UN Charter. So the Charter is framed by certain purposes and principles, including respecting international law, respecting human rights, the obligation of good faith, and cooperating in matters of humanitarian character. And I argue that the vetoes we're seeing are at odds with these obligations. Article 24.2 says the Council must adhere to these. If the Council must adhere, individual permanent members cannot have greater powers to violate the Charter. And individual permanent members are also bound by these Charter purposes and principles because they're states, and states are bound by the Charter. My third argument looks at the veto in the context of certain treaty obligations. Regarding genocide, it's the obligation to prevent genocide found in Article 1 of the Genocide Convention. And in terms of war crimes, or the obligation to ensure respect for the Geneva Conventions found in Common Article 1, common to the 1949 Conventions, and Additional Protocol 1. All permanent members are parties to the Genocide Convention and at least the 1949 Geneva Conventions. The ICJ in the Bosnia-Serbia case gives very serious content to this obligation to prevent genocide. It says it's a due diligence obligation based on a state's capacity to influence. So if we think of the permanent members, they have a particularly strong capacity to influence by virtue of being on the council, but also in their bilateral relationships. The ICJ also says it's not just an internal obligation, but external. And there they're adjudicating Serbia's responsibility vis-a-vis genocide in another state. And it's also triggered when there is a serious risk of genocide. We don't have to wait for genocide to be acknowledged to be occurring. It's simply the serious risk that triggers these obligations. We have similar obligations under Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions. The ICJ and the Wall in Nicaragua cases emphasizes this is also an obligation that contains external responsibilities to ensure respect beyond one's own state's territory. And the ICRC writes about this being a due diligence obligation as well. So our vetoes that we're seeing are not measuring up to these three obligations. And at the end of my book, I argue that states need to start raising these much more. And note that my arguments are a step beyond what they're doing now, which is voluntary veto restraint. If there's time, we can mention the French-Mexican Initiative Act Code of Conduct, endorsed by nearly two-thirds of the UN, that there should not be a veto used in the face of atrocity crimes. I'm going one step further and saying there's legal problems with it. And I'm saying states need to, that, you know, agree with this analysis, need to start making these arguments more at the UN. Some have already been making these kinds of legal arguments, particularly in the face of the Syria vetoes. I've seen them. States on the General Assembly states could also consider a resolution recognizing some of these hard law limitations. And they could also send a question to the ICJ, such as, is all veto use while there's ongoing genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, consistent with international law? A simple question like that. So that's my book. In the 5 or 7 minute version, I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jennifer. That was terrific. Mohammed, why don't we turn to you? And I just wondered if you might tell us a little bit about the impact that the use of the UN Security Council veto has had in the Syria context.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much, Jennifer, for the presentation of the book. Indeed, you've done an amazing job really outlining and analyzing the use of veto by Russia and by China in most of the cases where both countries went hand in hand in using the veto in the case of Syria. I'll give a little bit of summary of that, but what that meant for the people of Syria, because the first veto ever we've seen in Syria was in the summer of 2011, where the council was merely trying to condemn the use of force in Syria. And there's not much in it. Like, it's not Iraq war, it's not Libya resolution where Russia was worried the US and the NATO will overstretch the mandate and the resolution, just go into military intervention, just condemnation, verbal condemnation of the violence. So that set the stage clearly for the Syrian government that you had a cover in the UN and you have a green light to start committing more violations. Violations escalated. I was personally in the second veto session on February 4th, 2012. We were waiting for the council to vote in a session. A night before, the government used surface-to-surface missiles for the first time, at the night before the Security Council session, because they knew there would be a veto and nobody will be basically trying to hold them accountable or pressuring them. And the argument for the Syrian diplomat, Ambassador Bashar Jaafari at the UN, was like, oh, are we crazy to use surface-to-surface missiles before the session, just hours before the session? But you knew there would be a veto from Russia and China hand in hand. And you look on those vetoes, all of them, and the analysis Jennifer put in the book in the Syria chapter as a case study, they were not really trying to block unnecessary use of force or regime change, as Russia always tried to argue on those diplomatic statements before the voting on the sessions. Well, actually, the contrary. they were blocking civil civilian safe corridors or passages from Aleppo as exits. They were blocking humanitarian aid to Aleppo, where Aleppo was under siege. They were blocking the creation of investigative mechanisms to investigate the use of chemical weapons. They were blocking the renewal of the mandate of those investigative mechanisms. What did that for Syrians? A, we were hopeless. The UN is handcuffed by the veto. Nobody is going to help us. That played a lot to the narrative of the extremists in Syria. You like it or not, this happened. Nobody will help us. The UN is handcuffed. Let's pick up arms ourselves and let's fight ourselves. So that slided the whole conflict to the right, where people found that the UN, the entity, was tasked and mandated by peace and security, is not doing that, is doing the contrary, protecting the party in the conflict who's committing the violations and abusing and violating peace and security. So let's do it ourselves in our own terms. And that introduced all sorts of militias, armed groups, all the way to ISIS. And we know the rest of the story, how the peaceful uprising slided quickly within less than a year to become an armed conflict between both sides. But I want to go back to the use of chemical weapons, because it was a very interesting case for us. We worked a lot on the documentation of the use of chemical weapons. And the important point of the vetoes, there are 6 vetoes on the chemical weapons alone. And you look at it, you read between the lines, and very all clear all over the wall, as they say, the writing, like, you're not going to name in your mandate the perpetrators. If you try to name and try attribute blames to users of chemical weapons, we're going to veto you. The renewal is coming up. We're going to veto the renewal if you accuse the Syrian government. So it was very clear from the Russian and the Chinese government, but from the Russians more, that the use of chemical weapons is kind of protected. And if you name a perpetrator in your report, we're going to veto your renewal and you no longer exist. And Russia didn't only veto the renewal of the GEM, the Joint Investigative Mechanism between the OPCW and the Security Council, but they also vetoed the proposals by countries like Japan to renew the GEM for 1 month only while the deliberation of its mandate continues in the background. So they've vetoed all basically measures to try to do documentation and investigation by the UN on the use of chemical weapons. I want to take Jennifer's point about the use and reintroduction of chemical weapons because there's a protection in the conflict. And I want to use the flip side to that. And when the use of chemical weapons happened and President Trump decided to use military force twice in Syria without a Security Council measure, because this also tells you how bad the veto, because setting the stage for using military forces without international legal coverage, without support from the UN Security Council, only because 2 members of the council were threatening to use the veto. So chemical weapons were used in 2017, 2016, the first time. The deliberation is very hot between Ambassador Nikki Haley and between Vitaly Chorkin, who was still in the council. And they had to cut the session and to come back tomorrow for the next day to continue the deliberation. And the night the US decided to do the military strikes, the missiles, without going back to the Security Council. And they did it the second time the same, because Russia was threatening to use the veto on punishing the Syrian government for using the chemical weapons. US, UK, and France ended up acting together militarily without a UN coverage. So threatening to use the veto on protecting the Syrian government didn't only facilitate the use of chemical weapons, but also allowed other members of the state, of the council, to go and use forces without a coverage from the council. And the Russians couldn't argue much. Clearly the Russian, I watched those sessions detail by detail. I still imagine the face of the Russian ambassador to the UN. I was so surprised that the session was in hold to be discussed the next day, and the US decided to go on a military action at night without talking to anybody. This is exactly what you planted in this council, Russia. This is what you did for years of vetoing anything related to Syria, including vetoing just basically investigative mechanisms and putting conditions on the results of the investigation ahead of mandating them. It's just outrageous. It just tells you who's clearly using the chemical weapons. I want to take one final example in the use of chemical weapons is Aleppo, and the use of veto, sorry, is Aleppo. The siege of Aleppo and the starvation of people and the campaign of barrel bombs raining the city day and night with barrel bombs and with missiles, targeted missiles by the Russian air forces. and how that frustrated everybody and devastated the city of Aleppo and pushed thousands of people just to leave and become displaced refugees. So they created this humanitarian crisis, a human-made displacement in a massive scale. They protected it by a coverage by the, unfortunately, under the UN umbrella this time, and they couldn't really do much than passing a Security Council resolution sponsoring a safe passages of civilians. This resolution, where the UN took so much pride on it that they sponsored civilian passages, was called out by the UN Commission of Inquiry in Geneva as a contribution to crime against the humanity of forced displacement of population. Because you sponsored a resolution under the UN to displace people, not to protect them. That was a fake option you provided to the people here, and you're offering them to be displaced or to be killed. Let alone the entire campaign of Russia of targeted airstrikes on hospitals and bakeries and civilian objects in Aleppo that frustrated the elements of life in Syria. Where we're left now with Syria, nobody trusts the UN. The UN failed the Syrian people and set up an example for a failed international reactions for such a big crisis in Syria. And President Obama just published his book, and he admitted actually Syria, the foreign policy in Syria was one of his biggest failure of his administration, that he couldn't galvanize the support for the international community to stop the conflict in Syria or to help the people in Syria. But I'll conclude by one comment on basically what it meant for Syrians to be so frustrated, specifically in the accountability measures. Russia and China vetoed a referral to the ICC in early 2014, and we were left with no solutions, really. There's no jurisdiction for the ICC at its own. There's no hybrid tribunal could be passed either because it needs a Security Council resolution. We ended up with a kind of a new trend in accountability mechanism, the creation of the independent, impartial international mechanism to investigate in Syria, IIIM, which we had to go through the General Assembly to pass because Russia will veto it otherwise. But of course, this is a great card with Russia to call the mechanism illegal every session there's a renewal for the mechanism. And even during with moving the mechanism from voluntary contributions to the UN budget, Russia used all of its power really not to protect peace and security in the world, actually to do the opposite and to cover a war criminal using the force in Syria. I'll stop here because the Syria case, I could go more on the details, how that impacted the people in Syria. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mohammed. Ambassador Sheffer, you have such a vast experience in this area. I wonder if you would give us the benefit of your views, both on the arguments that Jennifer is advancing and on their application in the Syrian context.
Thank you, Asli. Jennifer has written a truly clear, articulate narrative. She is telling you, this is how the Security Council works, this is how it has failed in its mandate, and this is what is the reality in confronting atrocity crimes. So it's extremely educational. The thing that has impressed me the most in Jennifer's book is Jennifer's ability to take the Jus Cogens principles of international law and juxtapose them to the use of the veto power and demonstrate not sort of the hypocrisy of permanent members of the Security Council simply using the veto as a mechanism to actually violate Jus Cogens principles, which they cannot do as a state. They're not supposed to do it as a state. But somehow when they enter the Security Council chamber, hey, they can do it within a collective setting. Let's violate Jus Cogens principles. Let's just throw the veto in. And we have no liability because we're doing it in the Security Council, which is a perversion of the UN Charter's original purpose. It's just a perversion of what was negotiated in 1945. And yet we have arrived at that reality within the Security Council very largely over the last 20 years. And I also appreciated, Jennifer, your highlighting these Jus Cogens principles, particularly in the context of atrocity crimes, because quite frankly, once you get beyond atrocity crimes, there's very often a debate about whether it's this particular violation of international law is either a violation of Jus Cogens or of customary international law. And there's a distinction, as you write, between the two. But when it comes to genocide, when it comes to crimes against humanity and serious war crimes, it's not very debatable. It's pretty solid. And so you've used a very firm pillar of international law in order to challenge the cavalier use of the veto in the Security Council. So I applaud you for that, because there's a clarity to your argument, which is very profound and persuasive. Of course, it has to jump over political hurdles, but I don't think it necessarily has to jump over many legal hurdles. I do a lot of thinking and writing occasionally about, do we interpret the UN Charter precisely as the founders thought in 1945, or should we have a modern interpretation of the UN Charter that recognizes the realities of our world in the 21st century? And I focused on this particularly on use of force in a chapter of a book edited by Professor Leila Sadat at Washington University, St. Louis. And you know what? While I referenced those initial efforts, Jennifer, on the veto, I forget their names, you know, the Liechtenstein and then the other initiative.
French Code of Conduct and French Mexican.
Yeah, exactly. I've never memorized them, but I know they're out there, or they were. And I recognized in this chapter, which was published long before your book came out, that there was an attempt to deal with this problem. And guess what? It is failing. So where are we? Where are we in trying to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of individuals who are at risk or and perhaps dying already because of genocide, crimes against humanity, or serious war crimes? Do we simply stand back and let it happen because the Security Council is gridlocked, or do we act? And so in my writing, I have tried to resurrect the principles of humanitarian intervention, which in your book, you say, well, wait a minute, we don't want, I think I've got you right. We don't want to fall back into a world of humanitarian intervention. We want the Security Council and the Charter to work rationally and logically and effectively, because that's the regime we live under. That's our codified regime, the UN Charter. My argument has been the codified regime has failed so far with respect to these three baskets of crimes, and we have to have some alternative. So I argue for a new rationale for humanitarian intervention, but it's because I cannot solve the veto problem. So what I so appreciated in your book is, well, David, wait a minute, let's solve the veto problem and come back within the UN system. And I think it's a brilliant gift to us, because you keep the arguments at a clear, simple level. In other words, it's not a sophisticated legal concept that only a few ICJ justices might understand or judges might understand. It is actually, you put forward arguments that the general public can understand. And by the way, I just wanted to say, Mohammed, just found your presentation a remarkably clear reminder of how wrong the world got it on Syria. And of course, that's in part because of the failure within the Security Council.
Jennifer, I wonder if you wanted to respond to some of these presentations. Sure. And I wonder if there's a way you think about the prioritization of the different strategies that you identify as possible ways of addressing the problem. And specifically, I wonder if you share my view that the ICJ advisory opinion, while a desirable and exciting approach, because it would be an authoritative statement that would endorse, presumably, your reading of international law and the relationship to the veto, it of course faces the challenge that the ICJ has, you know, four of its judges are drawn from the P5. And so they may, and it's generally speaking, a more kind of conservative body, and then also advisory opinions have had limitations in what kind of influence they've been able to have in this arena, whereas they've been very influential in some other circumstances. When it comes to peace and security, they've they've been more timid or conservative as an institution, and their the reach of the advisory opinions influence has also been more limited. So I wonder if you would agree then that on my reading, the General Assembly strategy seems like the more powerful approach, particularly because of the IIIM and other evidence that we have of the General Assembly's willingness to move forward and really demonstrate that there is a, let's say, legislative majority in the international system that is equally frustrated with the way that the P5 have been operating.
Well, thanks so much. And thank you to Mohammed for reminding us that these maybe academic arguments by me, but they play out to the people on the ground. And it's, you know, it's really extremely serious what we're talking about. And I think you've shown that very, very persuasively. David, one thing I wanted to follow up, you said the ACT Code of Conduct and French-Mexican are failing. And just to draw, to complete that for the audience who may not know, they're successful in getting a lot of support. They're successful in getting two P5, but when they don't get the other three P5, we don't have voluntary veto restraints. So I think that's what David meant. They've galvanized, there's a problem here, and they ask the P5 to voluntarily restrain themselves. But when only the UK and France endorse this, we don't have veto restraint. And it's interesting, David. Yeah, I think humanitarian intervention, I do kind of in my book explore the UK is still bullish about humanitarian intervention. And I do kind of understand this. Most of the UN system is too leery of this doctrine to really endorse it. And I argue that, you know, if we actually fixed the veto, we wouldn't even be tempted to go down the humanitarian intervention route. I've written at least just in enough of a gray area of legality not to be the crime of aggression. So that's kind of where I go with it.
Right.
In terms of Osley's question, a strategy, I think the first one, I simply have to get my ideas out there. And I have been meeting with legal advisors at UN missions, meeting with states. I'm simply trying to get these ideas known. So that's definitely step one. And then when I argue that states could use these statements that these UN, that's something, you know, that's fairly appealing to states and that they could start doing as well. And some already have been doing it. I don't have to pick a priority between a GA resolution or ICJ decision, because at a certain point, this stops being my idea and states have to take this and they have to take the temperature within the General Assembly. Is there more interest in a GA resolution or an ICJ referral, or do you pursue both? GA resolution, when they could control the text of it. ICJ, you're, you know, asking an open-ended question to a court that sometimes has been conservative. On the other hand, in the Myanmar case so far, they've given a good ruling, and in the Bosnia-Serbia case, they've given a lot of good law. So I actually, you know, I'm somewhat bullish also about going to the ICJ. But ultimately, I think the priority is not for me to pick, but at a certain point, states need to run with these arguments.
So thank you again, Jennifer, for bringing your arguments here and giving us an opportunity to think about a better way of organizing international peace and justice through the existing order that we have at the UN. And thank you to all of the panelists and to all of our audience for joining. We're delighted to have had you, and we look forward to future events together.